Some call me Steve, Dad, husband, or friend. Others might call me boss, coach, or mentor. Today, you can call me the Leadership Hacker. Thanks for listening in. I really appreciate it. My job as the Leadership Hacker is to hack into the minds, experiences, habits, and learning of great leaders, C-suite executives, authors, and development experts so that I can assist you developing your understanding and awareness of leadership. I'm Steve Rush, and I'm your host today. I'm the author of Leadership Cake. I'm a transformation consultant and leadership coach, and can't wait to start sharing all things leadership with you. Martin Clark is a special guest on today's show. He's the CEO of Gadfly Consulting and author of the new book, Love Incorporated, The Future of Business. But before we get a chance to speak with Martin, it's the Leadership Hacker News. Throughout the world, there are a number of football or soccer tournaments happening. You have Copa America, and of course you have the Euros. Some of the world's biggest and most influential players and managers come together to showcase their skills and capabilities. So I wanted to explore, what can we learn from some of the best football and soccer managers in the world? Jose Mourinho is one of the best and most successful managers of his time. He has a theory of aligning personal ambition to team objectives. He offers each player a deal. If they commit to his philosophy, which will bring them success as a team, he'll do everything in his power to make sure he brings success to the individual. So by aligning the individual ambition to the team's objectives, Jose Mourinho creates a clear line of motivation which enables him to create the ideal environment for team success, which is a combination of high stakes and high belief. Pep Guardiola has conquered every league he's ever led teams in. At both Barcelona and Bayern Munich, Pep Guardiola didn't just get his players to buy into the mission, but into a particular way of playing. Barcelona always had a reputation for their flair, and Bayern Munich had a reputation for their domestic success. Yet for both clubs, winning was no longer enough. They had to win a certain style, a certain way, and Pep Guardiola focused on why. And that why was to enable an articulation so that all the players could get behind and buy into the belief system that was driving passion and energy into football. So the why, in his belief system, established loyalty, trust between the players and the manager. Claudio Ranieri has managed clubs in the US as well as across Europe. But whilst as manager of Leicester City in the UK's Premier League, he achieved the seemingly impossible by winning the Premier League. In a league that's traditionally dominated by money, Leicester City's wage bill was a snippet of the other teams around them. And what Claudio Ranieri achieved was to make each player play with a level of passion that money couldn't buy and a commitment to fight for each other. Wes Morgan, the team's captain, described Claudio Ranieri as creating a brotherhood. Claudio Ranieri said that the secret of getting people to put others ahead of themselves is in fact a selfish endeavour. Now this may seem paradoxical, but the strongest human instinct is the instinct for self-preservation. We're all wired to survive. And we survive by being a pack. We're drawn to be part of packs in order to ensure survival. Especially if that pack provides us with a level of significance and security. So once established, Claudio Ranieri's pack, or brotherhood, established a real fight to remain together as a pack and to work together. Jurgen Klopp joined Liverpool Football Club, a club full of rich history and tradition that had waned for many years. His successful mental approach was demonstrated in the quarter-final of the European Cup. Liverpool were playing Borussia Dortmund, and at half-time Liverpool were 2-0 down and needed 3 goals in the second half in order to win. During his half-time team talk, Jurgen Klopp turned a negative situation into a highly positive one by focusing on opportunity. He urged his players to create a moment to tell their grandchildren about, a night to make fans that they would never forget. The team went out in that second half and ended up winning the match 4-3 and booked a place in the semi-finals. And Klopp understood the psychology of leadership here and understood that high performance occurred when people are in a positive state and not in a negative state, and turned the negative 2-0 into an opportunity for positive outcomes. So whether you're a football or a soccer fan or any sports fan, there's always opportunity for us to learn from leaders and managers in other walks of life. That's been Leadership Hacker News. If you have any news, insights or stories, please get in touch with us. Joining me on the show today is Martin Clark. He's the CEO at Gadfly. Gadfly is a creative studio and leadership consultancy that uses creativity and design to transform the way people work and live. Martin is also the author of the book Love Incorporated, The Future of Business. Martin, welcome to the Leadership Hacker podcast.
Thanks, Steve.
So when we worked together last, it was about 8 or 9 years ago, and we've reconnected at the beginning of this year. And what I learned is you've been on a really incredible journey that I hadn't even known about. So for our listeners, perhaps it would be really useful if you could just give us a potted career history and then explain a little bit about your most recent personal journey.
Yeah, sure. I'm laughing at the introduction because I recognize all the words, but hearing it coming back at me, I'm like, you know, sometimes when you write things or say things or explain yourself, it's like,
Oh, that's what I do.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. I love that about conversation. You know, we can clarify things for each other. So I'm looking forward to this opportunity to do that.
Me too.
My story, do you know, they're the easy answers. I have a tendency to start with what I studied, physics and music. But the more difficult story is the more personal one. And I think those more difficult stories have value. So I grew up in a fundamentalist household, very, 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 very strict. Like I wasn't allowed to dance or listen to music that I had a beat. I wasn't allowed to do karate because that's violent and evil. There was a list, like as long as you can imagine, of stuff that I wasn't allowed to do. So I grew up in Switzerland, in southern England, watching people who had freedom to do whatever they wanted to do from inside this tiny little box where I was allowed to do almost nothing of what I wanted to do. And I just sat with that tension as a child. And I knew it, you know, from age 5, 6, I was aware of this, like really aware of it. And I was a naturally very, very curious, very eager to explore the world kind of kid. Still am. And I just wanted to explore everything. So I would find ways to explore things without exploring them or without anyone seeing, because I was at the heart of this fundamentalist community where everyone was watching me. So not only was I in a fundamentalist community, but my dad was the minister.
Right.
And that meant everyone was watching me and I was meant to be an example. And I knew this from age 6, that I was the minister's son and therefore expected to be good. And I already didn't care. Like I really just didn't care about being good. But I knew what would cause problems for me and I knew what would get me rejected by everybody.
So did you start to notice that there was an opportunity to exploit and how you might do that rather than being incognito, but how you could do that more publicly?
Well, right. So I explored the community that I was in. I explored what I was allowed to explore, like right to the very, very, very edge. So I learned a lot about where the edge was and learned a lot about people and how they work. And like one of the elders in the church was a chief executive, another was a chairman of an international corporation, and I hung out at their houses, and like they weren't as narrow as my parents were. So I lived in this tiny little box. They lived in a much, much bigger box. So I was constantly darting in and out of different boxes, as I called it in my head. You know, one day spent driving the personal tank collection of the CEO. Another day spent with his son and his motorbike collection, knowing I wasn't allowed to drive tanks, knowing I wasn't allowed to ride motorbikes. And just kind of going, how far can I go without getting in so much trouble that my whole life will be wrecked? So I became very, very aware of boundaries and edges. And people's limitations, so people's emotional limitations, and very, 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 very curious about all of that. And I guess that's why and how I ended up studying physics and music, and how I just ended up exploring people and how they communicate and systems and how they work and how people communicate within systems. And I mean, when I was seven, I decided I wanted to fly in Concorde to New York to have cool meetings, to do cool stuff, to travel the world, to influence things, to change the world, to, you know, I had this idea of how the world worked because I saw these guys who had this freedom that I didn't have. And I just wanted that freedom, really. That's what I wanted. And of course, 30 years later, after meandering my way through studying music and physics, and I did a bit of neuropsychology and earth science, and did a degree in rocket science, and like I just meandered through life, and then found myself in the position where I was flying around the world working with leaders, doing cool stuff in cool places, realizing that it felt kind of shallow to me.
Isn't that kind of ironic after that early experience of having now created that personal freedom for you, then feeling still a little empty?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to get too deeply into my own self psychoanalysis, but there were two aspects. One, I was looking for freedom outside myself rather than inside, and two, I realized that this system was as trapped as I was, and these people were as trapped as I was, and that at the core of capitalism as it is currently structured and companies as they currently are run is a form of ideological fundamentalism, just like what I grew up with.
How did you come to that conclusion? Where did that sense of realization for you come from?
Well, particularly coming up to the crash in like 2007 to 2010, I was doing like incredible projects where I was just given free rein to flow around organizations, talking to people, and basically untapping the potential of organizations, like trying to work out what is the thing that is sticking them, that's stopping them from changing in very big ways. So I was working on retainer for some of the largest banks in the world, and many other companies as well, but the banks are the ones that really, really, really struck me. Because I knew the crash was coming, because I felt like I understood how people were talking. I saw the numbers in the boardroom. I was working with a number of boards at the time. And everyone was trying to avoid it, avoid talking about it, avoid thinking about it, avoid the consequences of it. And I was looking at this thinking, these are some of the most powerful, influential people in the world. These are the equivalent of those guys that I grew up with, chairmen and CEOs of international financial organizations, and all they really care about in terms of how they make choices, right? Not in terms of how they talk, not in terms of what they feel, but in terms of how they make choices,
right?
All they care about, when it actually comes down to the value system, all they care about is money. Like the only thing that matters in that boardroom is money. The only thing that matters in that system is money. And it doesn't matter how many initiatives you do or change programs or how much leadership training you do, if the fundamental philosophical building block of the system is what do we do to get more money, the behaviors all flow from that.
Right.
So like in that period, I had freedom to roam, basic, and I roamed the whole organization to try to get an answer to this question. I talked to janitors, I talked to security guards, I talked to the people who worked in audit, in financial crime. I was in group services, HR, in the boardrooms, in the retail side, in the back end side, in the money collection side, in debt. I covered basically the whole of financial services in 3 years, every aspect of the system, trying to understand what is the driving force and how can that be changed. If this is the banks being really at the core of how we structure society, like your credit rating tells other people whether you're a good person or not. And I just wanted to understand this. I remember sitting in, I think it was the NatWest, the old NatWest boardroom in London at one point. It's like the boardroom that's in Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
It may actually be the boardroom that's in there.
It could well be actually. Yeah.
But it's an oak paneled leather desk boardroom. And I remember sitting there, like looking at the care with which that place was put together. Because it's like maybe 120 years old, that particular room. And I was sitting thinking, this is not what the people who built this organization initially intended. What's gone wrong? They cared about something more than money. So what's happened? How did they accidentally build a structure that has turned into something that only cares about profit? And it's like sitting in that boardroom, I was waiting for an executive, right? I was getting paid a full day rate, and I'd flown down from Scotland, where I was living, to London, sitting waiting for a whole day doing a half-hour session, and I got paid for a full day. And I remember sitting thinking, I'd completely forgotten about this, actually, Steve. Really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I remember sitting thinking, do you know what? When I grew up around Mr. Williams and Mr. Ide dreaming of flying on Concorde, I had a different idea of how these organizations ran, and it was a Christian idea, because they were coming at it from a fundamentalist Christian, well, they weren't so fundamentalist, but they were coming at it from a deeply Christian perspective. And I started thinking of experiences that I'd had in other organizations, like in the Royal Bank of Scotland in Edinburgh, sitting in the boardroom there, and looking at the pictures of the old directors who were elders in the Free Church of Scotland and the Church of Scotland. I was like, oh, okay. So what we've done is we've taken what was a relatively neutral frame, a legal frame for these organizations, which is, as directors, you have to do your best. Legally, you are obligated to do your best for the organization, to grow the organization, to provide. And the rest is up to you as an individual. And the rest is up to you as an individual, what moral or ethical frame you choose to put over the top of that. Because the people who founded these organizations didn't think for a moment that anyone would ever get to be a director who didn't have their own personal ethical frame that was about how the world should be, or how we should behave, or how people should be treated. So there was an implicit assumption that companies would have a human aspect to them, and that there would be a strong value system that meshed together with the corporate value system to create something that was socially beneficial to all.
We've seen quite a lot of that shift in certainly the last 5 years or so, where that human-centric approach is becoming much more prevalent, but there's still a bunch of work to be done, right?
Well, see, I would say in the last 5 years, we're starting to have the conversations.
Yeah.
Even if I just think about that comparison, think about the directors who started these UK banks, just as an example. Most of the directors who started the UK banks also had poor houses.
That's right, yeah.
So they had their own charities that they paid for out of their own pockets to keep thousands of people in basic work in homes. So they might have been getting paid 20 times what the average worker was getting paid, but most of their money actually went to the community.
Mm.
So they saw it as their duty to use that money to benefit community, and they saw their capacity to make decisions and their capacity to make sense of the complexity of the world as a responsibility, not just about whether they can get a second home in the south of France.
Lots of the experiences that you've had, particularly in transitioning from your corporate careers through consultancy, has been the foundations of the book that you wrote, Love Incorporated. But before we get into that, and would love to dive into that with you, it'd be really interesting if you could also maybe share for our listeners some of the recent challenges and how you've applied some of the similar thinking in order for you to take the next steps in your personal journey.
Yeah, so that journey through corporations ended very abruptly for me, not because of the crash. I was actually doing fine during the crash. I had plenty of work, lots of exciting opportunities. But I ended up moving house, and I wanted to rent for a while to have the freedom to move. Like I was really questioning lifestyle, questioning choices. Ended up renting an apartment that, well, it turned out 3 years later, I discovered that it had mold in the walls and in the ceiling, toxic mold. But I didn't know that when at the time. So I moved into this apartment, and within a month, I was just not feeling right. My lungs, I'd had asthma my whole life, and my asthma suddenly got worse. This happens sometimes. Asthma is just like, I had mild asthma. I was a hill runner and athlete, and it never stopped me from doing anything. But there are moments in life and periods where it's just worse. And I was like, okay, it's a little bit worse. I'll just cancel some of my work and give myself a break and stay at home a bit more. And it just got worse. And I was put on oral steroids for the first time in my life, that's like the scariest ride I think that's possible chemically that I can imagine anyway. It's like a near-death experience in a pill.
Wow.
For me, at least. It's just like, it's extraordinary. It's like fear in a pill. And I deal very well with fear and high pressure, but that, my goodness. So I was on steroids for just a few weeks. And then came off and then got sick again and on steroids and off and sick again. And I ended up on steroids for almost a year, bone scans to check that my bones were okay, because steroids can leave bone density getting worse. But when you're taking fear and a pill every day, like, it's a real challenge. My meditation practice basically disappeared because I couldn't do it anymore.
Wow.
Not possible. Mm-hmm. Taking steroids, but I needed to breathing comes first before meditation, it turns out.
not a huge choice to take when you're that poorly, right?
You need to be able to breathe to be able to meditate. It turns out, try doing it without.
Yeah, well, it brings a whole new meaning to focus on your breath,
right? It's exactly, it's like, no, I'm gonna anyway. So I ended up with mycoplasma pneumonia, which is nursing home pneumonia. It's like what old people whose immune systems are dead get. I had it twice, ended up being allergic to the, oh my God, I'm glad I can laugh about it, because it's like telling the story. This isn't even half of it. But the antibiotics I took, turns out I'm allergic to. And that took me months to recover from. And of course, I needed steroids to recover from that. So it's like just caught in this whirlpool of pain, fear, and drugs. And it turns out that it was all because of mold in the apartment. And as soon as I discovered, we moved out, and my health started to immediately started to recover. But the journey of recovery, it's taken me 4 years. My goodness, it's 4 years and 2 weeks.
And when we last spoke, I recall you telling me that 4 years and 2 weeks, so it's still really important to time it. You know, you have a measure over this. But that took probably your biggest gig of your life.
Well, the biggest gig of my life was walking in the mountains. Like, I had to walk in the mountains for my health for 3 years every day. There was no medicine that I could take. I had become basically allergic to everything that would help me through having too many steroids, and my liver was damaged, and like just in a really, really bad place from this toxic mold. And the only thing that helped me to recover was walking in the mountains, like pure air, exercise. And it's like an antidote to chemical fear that steroids lead to. So I had to get myself out of that rut. And that led me, you know, walking in the mountains, moved to Italy, to the north of Italy, and ended up walking in the mountains, just looking down on the plains below that are polluted and have Milan in the middle. Thinking about and reflecting on all of those experiences I had in corporations. And I'd taken notes about all of my thoughts about this stuff, and had decided I wanted to write a book about it at some point. But thinking about it from the top of a mountain is a very different thing to thinking about it while flying to meetings in the city.
And you can almost feel that journey, feel that clarity of thought you have when you read your book, because you tell it in such a vivid story about the experiences and the thoughts that you were having at that time. You can almost bounce around the different stories as to how they were happening for you at that time. Is that where the kind of the real inspiration for Love Incorporated came from?
The inspiration came from frustration, really, which is like, it shouldn't be that hard to build organizations that are okay for people to work in. It shouldn't be that hard. Like, we're amazing, amazing creatures. We've built incredible civilizations. How is it that like 60 to 70% of people who work in large corporations have no motivation? Like, they're literally flogging themselves into work. I can't think of any single client that I worked with who was actually, what would I say, living a life that felt integrated.
Mm, that's probably a good word for it, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, so that lack of integration, I mean, disintegration, they're all interesting concepts, but ultimately I think it's about psychological splitting, and the splitting comes from the split in the system, which is it's fundamentally dehumanizing because it's missing half of what it is to be human. The mystery, the unknown, the spiritual, the empathy, the stuff that religion has tried to capture for thousands of years, like, was stripped out of organizations, and we're needing to find new ways to put it in. So I just decided, I've been trying to write this book for a number of years, and I just made a choice to write it. And I was like, okay, where do I need to go to write? I thought, oh, you know, I'll write in a cafe. So that was the beginning of it. I decided to go and write in a cafe in Lugano while Brendan, my son, was on work experience. And that was the beginning of a 3-week experience that I've tried to capture in the book. I just decided to just do it until I finished it. And as you know, the beginning of the book is actually about my own personal experience of trying to write about something so deep in places that feel like there's no room for feeling that.
Yeah. There are many paradoxes that you go through in the book, aren't there, in terms of that whole kind of yin and yang and trying to establish a sense of reality almost of what's happening for you at that time.
Yeah, actually trying to be really, really deeply honest about my own experience of trying to write about stuff that is very subtle, like it's right at the edge of my own awareness internally.
Mm.
And what does it take to have that wholeness, you know, to try to honor that wholeness inside myself? What would it take to build a company that honors that wholeness? What would it take to build a team that honors that wholeness? What would it take to build a whole system that honors that wholeness? It's like starting from that simple experience. It's a really simple experience. How can I find the peace that I need to write about this very deep stuff in a meaningful way as a metaphor for what it is to build a corporation that has space for people to be human?
So did you have to find that you needed to kind of close off these questions for yourself first before you then started to think of others?
No. Yes, no. I think it works both ways, right? I think through contact with others, I can experience more of myself. And through contact with myself, I can experience more of others as well. So what matters is doing something, right? I chose to do the go inside path for the book. I could have done the opposite. I could have interviewed all of my clients. And I think it would have led to the same place, just differently. Well, that'd be an interesting follow-up, wouldn't it?
Mm. Book number two.
Yeah.
Okay. So how do you incorporate love, and why do you see this as the future of business?
The title is Love Incorporated. It's interesting to me. I wrestled with it, as you know, from reading the book. But to me, it's about my internal wrestling to incorporate love into my life. I grew up in environments that talk about love all the time and don't show much.
Right.
So my journey in life was about learning to show love and talk about it less. And here I have a book that has the word love on it, and I'm talking about it.
The irony behind this, though, Martin, right, is that the word love, you just don't see it in business because it has this real strange notion that it's bagged with lots of other things that go on. And in its simplistic sense, how would you describe love in business?
Caring about anything other than money.
Right. Yeah.
Because money's too, caring about money is like a motorbike mechanic caring about a spanner. It's like, it's just not interesting, right? You don't, you know, some spanners are really cool. I'll give you that. You know, there are special spanners that have special purposes. But caring about money is, it's just a tool. We can build things with it. We use it to shift value around. And money's just not that interesting.
Mm. It's very true.
You know, even preparing for talking to you today, and I was thinking, well, what is my motivation for making money? What is my own personal motivation? And I've never really thought about it before, but my own motivation is one thing. I hate detail. So I want a life where I have no detail to deal with. And that means I need an assistant. That means I need someone to manage the stuff around the house, because I am basically allergic to detail. I'm completely allergic to, like, I just die. If someone sticks some detail on my desk, I just wither. Like, I'm detail fragile. It's like an allergy.
Okay.
So I had to, well, let's solve the system, the problems of a whole system, because that's not detail. And money is just a way for me to get away from detail.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I guess the opposite side of that is you are uber creative.
Yeah, which involves lots of detail.
And you often find that uber creative people just don't have that same attention to detail, and vice versa.
Yeah, and I've had to work to have it, to be able to put out there the things I want to. Like the details, reading the book, you'll see some of the details that I went through about, you know, wanting the size of it to fit in a pocket. And while I'm walking in the mountains, thinking about what I'm writing, trying to design that experience so that people have an attachment experience to the book itself. Mm. And I've designed books for many years, and I love watching people pick them up.
Yeah.
I try to design books where people's thumbs don't get in the way of things, and when they pick them up, it feels a certain way, because that's the relationship that people have with an object very often affects how they read it.
Yeah. What's really interesting is ergonomically your book feels very different as well in your hand to other books. So did you spend time thinking about that as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, the whole thing is designed super, super, super detail. Turns out, in order to avoid detail completely, you have to embrace it.
Another paradox.
Yes, maybe that's all it's about. Maybe Love Incorporated is just like incorporating love is a paradox.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Because when you incorporate love, you have to be willing to say no to people.
Yeah.
And you have to push people away, and you have to have strong boundaries, and you have to know what you're about as a business. So as we try to integrate the more human into business, we have to say, you know, this is what we're about. These are our values. This is what matters to us. This is what's meaningful to us. And I'm really sorry if you don't see that, but that's what we're about. And that's exclusionary. That is discriminatory. It will offend people. People won't like it. There are people who hate my book.
And what's the reason for that?
It's all about me. They didn't get to the bit where I write about maybe our personal stories are metaphors, and that's all.
Yes, exactly. And you wrap many of those in what you call the Gadfly principles.
Yes.
Sadly, we haven't got time to get into all of the Gadfly principles. Maybe that's another show. Maybe you could summarize for us what they are, and if I was reading the book or using those principles, how I might use them.
I guess they're my attempt to humanize my own company. That is my attempt to capture the principles by which I have worked and the people who've worked with me have worked over the years to promote change in organizations. And like, it's an imperfect attempt, but it's a bit like, you know, the 10 commandments of Gadfly. There just happen to be, how many of them are there? There used to be 87. I know I edited them down to 35 now, 35 commandments. And the purpose of the principles, it's really internal. Like, it's an internal document. It's for myself. It's for people who work with me. It's for clients. It's for people who want to engage with us as a company. But as the book is about how can we humanize companies, I framed it as this is how we came up with these principles. And if you know, the aphorisms, the quotes that are dotted through the book and the principles, the quotes are my attempt to summarize each section.
Yeah.
I wanted a way to find things more easily. Mm. For myself.
And make sense simplistically, I guess, of them is what I read from them.
Yeah, just to try to understand what I was writing about.
Yeah.
What was the essence of what I was trying to say? And the principles actually started out as a list of what I was trying to highlight in the entire book about how we work. as an organization. And it turns out these principles are really quite generalizable to any organization. There's some very specific things, but they're quite general principles based on the human condition in the workplace, because they have to be to do the work that I do. So that makes them generalizably useful, I guess, to other people. The principles that all of the people who've commented to me about the book, that's the section that they comment on. They say, oh, the stories were amazing, but you know those principles, I'm just still thinking about them.
Mm.
And I'm still thinking about them, you know.
The benefit in having them as principles is they're just there as nudges to get you to think about you and how you and your teams are behaving and performing. They're not rules to follow. They're just principles.
Yeah.
And they'll always evolve, I suspect.
And I numbered them for a reason. I numbered them so people would take them more seriously.
Yeah.
And people do take them more seriously because they're numbered. Like, it was just a list of stuff, but it looked silly as a list of stuff. But the numbers actually have left me taking them more seriously and realizing that there's real depth in them that I wasn't aware of when I wrote them.
And throughout the book as well, Martin, you've got these quotes that you alluded to, and they're kind of dotted throughout the book. And appear to be kind of almost reflections that you had at some point, either writing it or reflecting on what you'd written. And there are some belters in there, by the way. I really like them. There's some really thought-provoking ones. And my favorite, I'm going to tell you, is the more grateful we are for the things that we have, the more easily we can see the harm we cause by having them. And that got me really thinking around, okay, so I'm really grateful for having these things. And then being really thoughtful around, are they serving me well or are they serving a purpose? And it's just really thought-provoking nudge. Do you have a favorite yourself?
I have a number of favorites, but the one I can't ever forget is rain on windows connects us to nature, but the glass separates.
Mm, I like that.
And I can't forget it for two reasons. One is because I remember that storm hitting the windows and feeling so isolated from nature after walking the mountains for a week and being really grateful I was isolated from nature. and the other is that my kids, who are teenagers, always make fun of me using that one because they're like, oh, you think you're some Buddha or something. So it's like keeping me humble.
The kids do that wonderful thing of pulling you back into reality. You know, I often think of myself as a bit of a sage to my kids sometimes, and then I just get the dad look and then realize I should just maybe make a cup of tea or something else instead.
It's like having a daily reminder, you know, other people may think you're a cool dad, but we know you're not.
Oh dear.
Yeah, the other one I'd like to end with here, which is, I think, a summary of what I'm trying to do with my work with Gadfly, with the book, with everything, which is power and status come with responsibility. And if we ignore that, we cause harm.
Mm, very powerful.
That stares me in the face every day, every time I pick up this book. It's like, oh, it's easy to get caught up in stuff, in money, in getting places and success and all sorts of stuff that really doesn't matter, but that actually causes harm if we forget other things.
Yeah. So what's next for Gadfly and for you?
I think just getting out and doing more of this. So I'm currently creating a framework for doing organizational interventions based on all this stuff. So individual, team, divisional, whole organizational interventions that are based on the Gadfly Leading Change Framework, which is quite exciting. And we're calling it alchemy. So it's alchemy, personal alchemy, team alchemy, divisional alchemy, organizational alchemy, systemic alchemy. So this idea that if we take lots of inputs from lots of different directions, pick the system apart in all sorts of different ways, in human ways, in analytical ways, and we really allow ourselves to be whole, everything that we are, we create the conditions in which magic can happen. And that can lead to very, very, very fast, very deep, very profound, very impactful change in organizations, not just human stuff, but in terms of how organizations structure themselves, operate. Very, very powerful way of working.
How exciting. Look forward to seeing some of that work as it starts to evolve.
Me too. Me too.
So, This is the part of the show our listeners have come to affectionately know as our closeout cadence, or whatever it is that they label it as. But we get to spin the lens around and hack into your great leadership mind. The first place I'd like to go is to hack into your top three leadership hacks.
So I was thinking about this last night. Talking, listening, and laughing. Every intervention that I have done, every piece of work, the book, everything I do, I talk to people. And I talk with an intention to listen, to hear, to connect. And it almost always leads to laughter. And I won't talk and listen and not laugh. And I won't listen and laugh and not talk. And I won't talk and laugh without listening. So the three just, maybe it's just being Irish. So I think if you can all just be Irish, everything would be fine. So banter is the heart of how organizations work. And it doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter where you are. All of the work gets done through human connection.
Of course, the more you laugh, the more happy chemicals you release along the way, of course, and that only helps aid productivity.
Yeah, it helps your employees to become more addicted to the organization, right?
It does, yeah. Definitely so.
We're just creating a different kind of addiction.
Yeah.
People enjoy themselves. Oh.
So, hack to attack is the next place we're going to go to. Now, you've already described and shared a whacking great attack that came from a time in your life which was really tough for you. But from a corporate perspective, is there something maybe else in your life or work where that learning experience is now a core driver in what you do?
Yeah, I did a giant project. It was a $1 billion project that I was coordinating the human aspects of, bringing 10 corporations together into a co-creative space. It was a giant, 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 giant project. And I basically proposed that these corporations scrap their legal frameworks for choosing suppliers and try something new, which was basically human-centered corporate collaboration. And I'm laughing. I'm laughing because of there was a certain naivety about how I did it, but it was an incredible project, just incredible. Brought 10 very powerful teams together from around the world, and 10 corporations started to work differently together until the moment that I used one offensive word with one team in one meeting that triggered a blackmail. A $200 million blackmail of withdrawal of business from one company from the other in a giant power move that destabilized basically the whole industry.
Whoa.
Because it was a very high profile project. And the whole project collapsed basically because I used one word that someone found offensive. Of course, I don't think it was real offense. I think it was just an excuse to trigger a power move. But what I learned from that, following on, everyone in the industry heard about that project and everyone heard about what we were trying to achieve. And everyone heard that it was actually working. And everyone heard some of the outcomes of the project in terms of decisions that were made. And it turns out that the best thing that could ever happen was that project failing. Because it left so many people inspired to try something similar and to make it work. And that led to industry-wide change that wouldn't have happened if the project had been successful.
Often the case, isn't it?
Absolutely. Plus, there's more to laugh about because it failed. It's like looking back.
So ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
It's only when sometimes things do screw up that they provide us with that level of learning.
Well, I can talk to people and say, do you know what? Even if this fails,
yeah,
I know that it'll have an impact because I know we're doing something that's meaningful here. And I know it for these reasons, you know, and being able to have that confidence, it reassures people. You know, the worst that can happen is I personally will get removed from the project and blamed for everything. So I'll take the hit. That's fine.
Some more dinner party stories as well.
Yeah.
Awesome learning. Awesome learning. So the last thing we get to do is give you a chance of some time travel, get to bump into Martin at 21 and give him some advice. So what would your advice to Martin at 21 be?
I was trying to think of a serious thing to say. you know, something related to business or about.
But you got stuck then and thought, no, I've been far too serious now.
When I was 21, I had a girlfriend and I really loved her. She loved me, but we knew it just couldn't work. And it was a very innocent kind of not really heading anywhere fast. And we hadn't kissed. And I decided to not kiss her because I didn't want to hurt her because I knew it wasn't going to go anywhere. And my advice to my past self is that just kiss her. Come on.
Kiss the girl. Just kiss her.
And I think the lesson from that is actually about living with abandon. So there's a deep lesson in it, which is to know that we will cause harm. And like, it goes back to the power and status and responsibility thing. We know that we'll hurt people, whatever choice we make. We know that we'll cause harm no matter what we do. But actually life is just a bit of a ride and it's okay to enjoy it. And it's okay to mess up. And it's okay to make mistakes. And as long as we're paying attention to that responsibility and paying attention to how we are and our impact in the world, it'll all be okay.
Very nice words. Well said.
Thank you.
If our listeners wanted to get a copy of Love Incorporated, Martin, and learn a bit more about what you do, where's the best place for us to send them?
Amazon, any large online retailer has it. If you want an ebook, if you're not sure you want to commit to the, you know, to buying it, just send me a message on Instagram. I can send you an ebook free. Of course, undermining my sales of ebooks.
They miss out on the ergonomic feel of it, because genuinely, it's the best feel of a book I think I've ever had. That sounds really crazy as I'm saying it now.
That's very cool. No, it feels amazing.
Yeah.
And the paper smells very good as well. It's a full experience. It was designed as an immersive experience. So, and I thought very carefully about that because of the environmental impact. But I think some things are worth it. I tried to use that as a benchmark to make a book that's worth the paper, worth the destruction, that has value that it can add. And I believe it does.
Adds more value than it does destruction. How about that?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that's, buy online or get in touch. I'm more interested in conversation and having coffee with people than I am in book sales.
And we'll make sure we put some links in the show notes so people can carry on those conversations with you when we're done.
Cool.
I just want to say thank you, Martin. I love chatting with you. Always do. We always have a bit of a laugh and you always come from a completely different direction than anticipated in our conversations. And I love that about the work that you do as well.
I like that you avoided using the word crazy. It's good.
I might have said it unconsciously though with some other language you probably picked up on.
Thank you.
So on behalf of our tribe, thank you for being part of our community and thanks for being on the Leadership Hacker podcast.
Thanks for the opportunities too.
Thanks, Martin.
I genuinely want to say a heartfelt thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in too. We do this in the service of helping others and spreading the word of leadership. Without you listening in, there would be no show. So please subscribe now if you haven't done so already. Share this podcast with your communities and network and help us develop a community and a tribe of leadership hackers. And finally, if you'd like me to work with your senior team, your leadership community, keynote an event, or you would like to sponsor an episode, please connect with us via our social media. And you can do that by following and liking our pages on Twitter and Facebook. Our handle there is @leadershiphacker. Instagram, you can find us there @the_leadership_hacker, and at YouTube, we're just Leadership Hacker. So that's me signing off. I'm Steve Rush, and I've been the Leadership Hacker.